Our platform is today handling 2.5 million consultations a year. We've handled 8 million since I started 7 years ago. And as a comparison, I think that I made some sort of calculation that I had during close to 20 years in pediatrics met like 8,000 newborns. However, what I realized when I was on holiday with my husband, I woke up one morning and I was like, oh, but we have only changed those that were already prone to change. We left the rest behind. So what happened was that coming into tech company, I got exposed to other types of healthcare clients than those that I had worked for. So it was more private sector, of course, publicly financed. We are in Sweden, but publicly financed private sector that were willing to make strategic investments into digitalization, understanding that they wouldn't get return on investment until 5 years later. And then I woke up and I was like, okay, we've left 95% behind. It's the like real public sector. And it's still the case today, I would say.
Welcome back to our podcast series in which we're speaking to digital health entrepreneurs around the world and getting a sense of how innovation is happening outside the United States. More importantly, we're meeting some extraordinary people, each driven by a desire to make health better, more affordable, and more accessible for their fellow man or woman. In this podcast, we meet Dr. Anna Karen Bonamy, the CEO of Doctrine SE. Her journey starts as the daughter of a nurse working long hours in a remote part of the country, and then to her becoming a doctor herself and wanting to solve the access problem she lived as a young woman. We're joining Anna Karen in Gothenburg on a beautiful day at Vitalis, the largest digital health conference in the Nordics, where she has a booth and a team in attendance.
I was born and brought up on the Norwegian border, up in the mountains, actually, of Sweden, a very rural area in a village with 600 inhabitants. And the next biggest village is 150 kilometers away. That's about 100 miles. So that's where I spent my childhood. My mother worked as a district nurse, taking care of the community in healthcare. And I was, as a kid, I think, hoping that becoming a medical doctor would make it possible for me to change things in healthcare that she clearly wasn't able to change as a nurse. Unfortunately, it turned out that I was wrong. It was not possible for a medical doctor to change the healthcare system. First, there was a lack of doctors. I mean, nowadays people talk a lot about medical deserts. I think that might exist in the US as well. It's clearly a concept in France, for example, that all of the doctors want to stay in the bigger cities. So there's a lack of doctors. We had that up in the Swedish mountains already in the 1970s and 80s. Doctors were no longer available, which made my mother and her nurse colleagues to take a lot of responsibility for patients, like deciding whether to send them to the nearest hospital 240 kilometers away, for example. So people clearly died from the lack of medical care, I would say. And then the working hours, the working conditions where she could work around the clock for several days in a row. I didn't really get to see her that much as a kid. So I felt that there must be a way of doing this smarter. However, in the 1970s, technology wasn't around. I couldn't even imagine the possibilities that we have today. That was not on my mind. I clearly wanted to recruit more staff or simple solutions.
It is another important point to underline. The solutions we have today were largely designed for the problems of yesterday, with the tools available yesterday. Today is a new day. There are new solutions to those same problems, which can leverage tools that were not available yesterday. It's not that the status quo, how we do things today, is inherently wrong or bad, which is how often people who are trying to avoid change tend to frame it. They say there's nothing wrong with the situation as is. It's nothing wrong, perhaps, but it is outdated, and it doesn't necessarily meet the needs of the population. So much like a StarTAC flip phone is no longer the best solution for a portable phone, I can't imagine anybody given the option wouldn't take a smartphone. So let's get back to Anna Karen's journey and find out what she chose as a specialty as a doctor.
Pediatrics, because I think it's a deeply meaningful specialty, I think, because every penny you invest in a kid's future will give them a better quality of life for the next 85 years, if you're lucky. And then it's fun. I think that I like innovation, and I think that kids are by nature very innovative. So they see solutions where adults fail. And I think it's amazing. Eventually, I mostly worked with newborns, but that's also very special because then you have the family and the bigger family around that family as patients. And that's also a very meaningful experience. I'm no longer a practicing clinician. I quit that back in 2017. When I joined Doctrine, the company that I'm the CEO of today. However, during the pandemic, I did go back and do a few maternity rounds, etc., just because my colleagues are quite old, actually. Pediatricians tend to stay in business for a very long time. So all of those who were above 70 years of age couldn't work during the pandemic due to the risks of getting infected. So then I took a few shifts, but I'm not a practicing clinician. I'm still, however, academically active, not to the extent I was before, of course, but I'm an associate professor at the Karolinska Institute, at the Department of Clinical Epidemiology. I would say I didn't explore telemedicine or digital health early on. It was more of a stepwise process. I started doing academic research in parallel with my residency back in 2002. I got my first laptop, a light one, like 1.3 kilos, amazing, good battery life, fantastic. And then I did basic physiology. So I did lots of MRI studies, vascular stiffness, that kind of quite technology heavy PhD thesis. I got in touch with the first like algorithms. We could track the borders of the aorta automatically using software back in 2004, I think. And then I started programming myself mostly to be able to do my statistical analysis independently. I mean, using basic statistical software like SAS and STATA. So I wasn't at all into technology. I was more still into wanting to transform healthcare by being part of the system. So I got engaged in professional associations. I was on the board of the Swedish Pediatric Society for 5 years, first as scientific secretary and then as vice president. But I found that it was really incredibly difficult to change things. It could be something small, like wanting to improve a breastfeeding policy. I've been very involved in breastfeeding advocacy. It took us 18 months to write like a 2-page paper about it. We were going to change like how hypoglycemia was handled in maternity unit. It took us like 3 years. And I was like, I turned 40. And when I was 42, I was like, okay, I worked for half my professional life now. And at this pace, I will achieve nothing. It's just too slow. So then one morning I was having breakfast. I was scrolling through my Facebook feed and saw an ad, a job ad, which was for, "We want to radically improve healthcare," was the title of it. And I was like, yeah, I want to radically improve healthcare. What is this? I had never heard about a company. It was Doctrine. I read the ad. They were looking for a junior doctor to join the medical team. At that point, I was a senior consultant in pediatrics, associate professor at the Karolinska since 3 or 4 years. I had PhD students. I was a residency director, highly involved in all those activities that you're responsible of as a senior clinician. And 20 minutes later, I had applied for a junior doctor's position at the startup. That turned out to be without funding also at that point in time. Then I negotiated. We were leaving on holiday the day after my first interview. And I negotiated during 4 weeks with my family. I was like, I'm going to half my salary, or probably a bit worse than half. So you won't get any new clothes. We're not going on any nice vacation trips during the coming years. And they are out of money. So I might be without a job. But hey, I'm a pediatrician. I think we'll be fine. So I asked my kids, actually, could I please try? I really want to do this. They said, yes, go for it. After some reflection, they said, yes. Then I promised them some more time. I was like, it will be more flexible. I won't work night shifts anymore. I'm not sure it's more flexible. I didn't know that then. But I also left Karolinska, actually, at that time to go to another university hospital in Stockholm, where I felt that people were, I don't know if there's a diplomatic way to say this, but perhaps people and women were given more equal opportunities in their professional careers, slightly more friendly, perhaps less competitive atmosphere. And that was also very nice to see, like, how you're within a city as small as Stockholm, with most people having received their at least basic training at Karolinska, how you could have two hospitals with very different cultures and how that affected everything. Like the stress levels with the patients were actually lower because people were a bit more caring, a bit more friendly. And I think that although technical or like the medical level wasn't as advanced, I'm pretty sure it affected outcomes positively.
I am such a big fan of cultural exchange programs for doctors. particularly when the systems are close enough structurally that the learnings are transferable. There's great personal and human value in traveling and working in underdeveloped countries, no doubt, but the teaching is generally one way, at least the practical technical stuff. I'm not taking anything away from those experiences for those of you who are concerned about my statements. I mean, after I completed my US-based training, I worked in Bhutan and other countries, and it was an incredible experience. But I was mostly teaching and providing the best direct care I could in the circumstances. When I worked as a fellow in Italy's Rizzoli Orthopedic Institute, I was mostly watching and learning a completely different approach to care that I was able to apply directly to my practice when I returned to the United States. Today, I still visit surgeons whenever possible and always pick up some new idea, some new concept, some new way of thinking about a problem. So same is true of digital health space. There are so many ways to approach a problem, and the more ideas and solutions we come across, the more innovative we can be. Anna Karen clearly leveraged all that she had learned in her travels and was ready to embrace new technologies to enable those ideas. Let's hear more about how she approached her digital health journey.
The startup scene was obviously growing quite fast in Sweden, so with lots of companies that are now global, like Klarna. So I think that although I wasn't part of the startup scene, I think many people felt attracted to it and inspired by it. I had also done a research project with UCSF, actually, in cardiology for a few years. And my colleague's husband, he worked in a very senior position at Twitter at that time. So I was exposed to that environment a little bit during my travels to San Francisco. So I think I was partly attracted by the mission, like how to radically improve healthcare with technology, but obviously partly also attracted by just getting an experience from a totally different environment. What shocked me a bit was like how money at that time flowed quite freely. I had managed my own research budgets for about since I defended my thesis, more than 10 years, or approximately 10 years. So I knew the value of what can I do for 3 million kroner, that's about $300,000. What could I do with $500,000? And usually that was money that for me in a research project would last like for several years. I could have one PhD student for 4 years with that money. And then I entered the startup world where money at that time did seem to have a different value. But I didn't know whether that was because I came from the public sector. So I was like, okay, perhaps this is normal in business, like not becoming profitable, spending much more money than you actually earn. So I tried to adjust just by just listening in. And then it was like learning a new language. It was pretty much the same experience as I had moving to France when I didn't know French, moving into a startup business coming from the medical side without previous business experience. It was like, R-O-I, could you say that again? What does it mean? And then I was asking questions for 3 months. But then I saw that I could actually, because as I said, I applied for a junior medical doctor's position. But luckily, the founders, they kind of understood quite quickly that I had the experience of running really large projects, handling my own budgets, handling my own staff. So then they gave me a big project, actually, to build a part of our platform, which is our medical, still today, questionnaire engine, where I get to recruit a team of engineers in Poland. I get to explain how healthcare works. And then I gave them one of the best instructions I've ever given a team, I think. I was like, when you're done, I don't ever want to clean a data set again, because I had spent in my research doing statistical programming, like really cleaning the Swedish medical birth registry data sets. Every time I got data delivered, there was a week of data cleaning. And I was like, if you just please could handle the versions, the variables, only use unique variables, no duplicates, and just give me data that I never have to clean again, then I will be happy. And they managed with that quite small piece of instruction to build something that is quite amazing, actually. We, of course, I might have to explain what Doctrine is doing. Doctrine does 4 things. We connect patients with healthcare and healthcare with patients. We collect the information that is needed in every clinical situation for clinicians to be able to communicate and treat patients in an efficient way. And basically that means that we have a vast set of dynamic medical questionnaires that are adapted to the patient's condition, context, sex, and age, and to the previous answers to the question. So it's a tree-based structure. And that tree-based structure and that questionnaire engine is the product that I was responsible for building together with the team and later with product managers, obviously, etc. This means that in every consultation where doctrine is the technology behind that consultation, a lot of beautiful medical data about the symptoms that the patient has is gathered, but also about the patient's own expectations, about their concerns. So we also gather quite rich free text data. And that combination of free text data and structured data, I think, is a rich data source where we will be able to apply generative AI, for example, in the future to make consultations much more efficient. So that is what we did. And that is why it was so important for us that we didn't only gather information that could be used immediately in the consultation, but also to think about the future. How could this data be used in the future? Because we didn't have AI powerful enough at that time to make use of it, but we all understood that at some point in time, this will be possible. And I have to say that point in time appeared earlier than I thought at the time when we started gathering this data. I quit healthcare to like transform it from the outside. And at first, for the first 3 or 4 years, I was really congratulating myself because I thought we were successful because quite rapidly we acquired the biggest healthcare providers in Sweden as clients. Numbers of consultations grew very fast, like hockey stick fast, even before the pandemic. And they continue to grow, obviously, after the pandemic, and they still grow today. So our platform is today handling 2.5 million consultations a year. We've handled 8 million since I started 7 years ago. And as a comparison, I think that I made some sort of calculation that I had during close to 20 years in pediatrics met like 8,000 newborns, and now we've handled 8 million consultations. So it's definitely scaling. However, what I realized, I'll come back to the subject now, what I realized when I was on holiday with my husband, I woke up one morning, I think it was 2 years ago in the summer, and I was like, oh, but we have only changed those that were already prone to change. We left the rest behind. So what happened was that coming into a tech company, I got exposed to other types of healthcare clients than those that I had worked for. So it was more private sector, of course, publicly financed. We are in Sweden, but publicly financed private sector that were willing to make strategic investments into digitalization, understanding that they wouldn't get return on investment until 5 years later. And then I woke up and I was like, okay, we've left 95% behind. It's the like real public sector. It's still the case today, I would say. The public sector is behind, and you clearly see that in a conference like Vitalis here in Gothenburg, that they are talking about the things that we took for granted already 5 years ago. So they are using the messaging clearly, word by word, that we used 5 years ago. So that's like the higher level resistance to change. And I think that has to do with the public sector's inability to do strategic investments where you don't get return on investment within the same budget year or at least political mandate period, which is usually 4 years in Sweden. Then if you look like more at the mid-level, of course, there will always be resistance. But I think there is a misconception in healthcare that healthcare staff or healthcare managers don't like change. I think that is a misconception because I think that you cannot work one single day as a clinician without being really good at innovation. Because working in healthcare means that you will every day, every hour, be exposed to situations you haven't seen before, and you're usually personally responsible for solving them. So that's like a constantly ongoing innovation. So people are not scared of change, they are not scared of innovation. However, I think that what we as companies and other organizations like management consultancies, etc., expect from healthcare when we come in and we're going to do a project with them, we're going to implement a new solution, we're going to start a change managed program, we expect them to be able to spend time with us, at least a couple of hours a week. But usually that's not possible. And I think that is, they are so stressed working in healthcare. They are already working lunches. They don't go to the bathroom when they need to. And then we come there with this beautiful digital solution and we are just going to change your ways of working. And then you will be super successful. And look at this clinic. They have been super successful. Yes, they have been super successful because they let their project team invest 20% of their working time for a year to become that successful. But if you cannot see how to do that, you won't be successful. Then it will just be an additional tool, additional stress, etc. So I think the resistance to change we see in healthcare is quite natural. And luckily, we have been associating our, we have been actually followed by academic researchers from the Lund University. They contacted us 7 years ago and they said, could we do research on your implementations with customers? And we were like, yeah, you could. When will it be published? They were like, yeah, in 5 years. And we were like, 5 years, that's an eternity. But okay, let's do it. But now those studies are published and we know how to implement digital platforms like ours in a successful way to get the staff on board. What is needed? People need time. They need leadership that does not only procure the solution and then leave the team with it. The leadership needs to be there all along the way. They need to show continuous interest. And I think that what they also need is a common vision, and they need some sort of common end goals and a few KPIs along the way. But we also see that customers that can align around that vision and around that end goal, but then adjust as they go, they are clearly much more successful than those coming asking for very specific features. They have this very detailed project plan and they get very rigid. That's clearly a risk factor for failure when you're going to digitalize, especially now we are a mature solution, but a few years ago we weren't. We weren't even a stable platform. So you also need some patience to understand that not only healthcare is unstable and risking something in this change, the company is as well a risk. So that's a very special relationship actually working with the startup. Now we are mature, so now we know what the problem is. We know how to manage expectations, but we didn't in the beginning. And that was, of course, also putting additional pressure on the customers that were going to make this change. As you see, there are no simple answers.
Wow, so much wisdom in so few minutes. So let me recap, because I think this is really fantastic. First, an understanding the rapid adoption amongst the most invested is not the same as general adoption. It is important not to lose sight of the 95%. It's probably smaller than that, maybe 80%, but let's go with it. Second, the idea that providers are not scared of change, they are scared of innovation, perhaps because they may not understand it. It's an interesting point of view. Third, the fact that for technology to succeed, the team has to have 20% of their time assigned to implementation for a year. Now, this is in line with data from McKinsey. I think it was McKinsey that I once read that suggested that 40% of any digital transformation budget needs to be allocated to change management and not the technology. If not, failure is nearly guaranteed. It was like they looked at like several hundred implementations. It was so linear. Fourth, and hand in hand with that last third point, is the need for leadership to be visibly involved and not just hand off the project to middle management. A few years ago at the Digital Orthopedics Conference, one of our speakers was a senior leader at Google on the sales side. He described how whenever deciding whether to work with a new potential client or not, the first thing they did was to meet with the sponsor in the leadership team and see how committed they were to backing the change agent they'd selected. And if they couldn't get a solid commitment, they'd walk away from multi-million dollar contracts. If they didn't see that commitment, it just wouldn't work, and they knew it. They didn't want to waste their time. Fascinating. Fifth, the importance of managing expectations. Doing so is a sign of a company's maturity. Startups that promise the world when they're still writing the necessary code do not tend to fare well in the long term. So let's hear more about that concept, that idea of how to manage expectations, from Anna Karen, and also hear more about her leadership journey.
Let's talk about the managing expectations, because I'm not sure how I would do it if we were to start over again. But I clearly see that what we did in the beginning as a young startup was to overpromise and underdeliver. And that was not because we didn't work hard. It was because it's very difficult to build an advanced healthcare product with very high expectations on performance, stability, security, etc. And we also got very big clients like global healthcare providers, really big players early on in that journey. And of course, they were used to suppliers that were very mature. So I'm not sure that we did wrong by over-promising and under-delivering, but that was a very painful way of doing it, I can tell you that, because we had very angry clients for several years, because we had shown them roadmaps, when is this fantastic feature going to be released, and sometimes the clients started planning their business around that feature release, and then we didn't release it, or it didn't work as expected, or lots of things. And then we came to some sort of tipping point when this was so expensive to us and so painful for the staff. It was a real working environment problem because people were sitting in client meetings with angry clients every day. And I was spending a lot of my time, even when I was appointed CEO, we're going to come back to that, just handling like crisis meetings with customers. I think that we got that really sense of urgency. We need to fix this. So we started being like brutally transparent, like saying we have absolutely no idea when this feature will be released. Or due to three people being on sick leave, this project might be 6 months delayed. People get a bit angry at first, but that anger was like nothing compared to the anger people get when you try to like pretend that everything is going well. I mean, we didn't do that on purpose, but I think that it was like a big, big culture shift, starting to be brutally, brutally transparent with customers. And I think that the reason, I mean, we could do that was that I have a very mature and stable leadership team that are willing to take like full accountability for their results and their failures. And that makes it easier for a CEO to be together with that team brutally transparent, because then the clients see that you work really hard and that you are a trustworthy partner. So that was an important change. And in parallel, we did another important change, and that was to involve almost every client actually very closely into the product development. Because we get better products, but they also get much more patient when they get to follow the process very closely. So I think that today we have quite strong customer relationships, strong customer ambassadors, and we get to build a much better product for healthcare by listening really to the customer's needs. Because sometimes we have a perception, I have worked for 20 years in healthcare, I might still today think that I know something about healthcare, but I'm quite often proven to be wrong when I actually go to customers. Is this your biggest problem? No, it's not. It's that problem. So you don't build a product to solve the wrong problem.
So interesting to see the similarities between businesses, in this case in Sweden and perhaps the United States and elsewhere in the world, in terms of how they manage customers. But I was very curious to get deeper a little bit about Anna Karin's journey to CEO and some of her learnings. So here we go.
I joined, as you heard, as a junior medical doctor. Then I got the responsibility for some bigger projects. And I was appointed chief medical officer of the doctrine quite early on, 8 months into the journey, when the board saw that I had the qualifications to take on that role, and the previous chief medical officer went into a more commercial role. And then I got the opportunity to meet more with clients, and that worked well. I got to meet with investors. We raised quite a lot of money that year, and that worked well as well. We had an externally recruited CEO at that time, because one of the founders experienced a severe burnout. He's very open. He actually founded the company later on, so he's very open with it. So he experienced a severe burnout. We had an external CEO recruited who was spent 1 year with us, who didn't have healthcare background. And after a year, we needed a new CEO. And then the board felt that this time we would prefer to have someone with a strong healthcare background, because obviously that is very important to our customers. And then they saw that it worked well for me meeting clients. It worked well with investors. So they asked me, knowing that I had like very limited business background, but they were like, it seems to be more difficult to learn healthcare than to learn how to be a CEO. So we will help you. So I took on that role, hoping, and that was in the summer of 2020. I also felt as a woman that given the opportunity, being asked the question, would you like to become the CEO of a tech startup? I felt some sort of responsibility actually for the female community to not say no, although I was almost dead scared. And then I had hoped that the pandemic would end sooner, because we were in the summer of 2020. And my leadership style is really like walking the floor, staying at a person's desk. What are you up to? Okay, how do you feel? Do you like it? Do you have any new ideas? And that was really a shock to me, to take over the leadership of a company for We stayed at home for close to 2 years, I think. And only being able to meet with people in Teams meetings. We had a very strong feedback culture in the company before the pandemic. It turned out to be impossible to keep that up, to give constructive feedback to people in a Teams meeting. How on earth do you do that? And as a CEO, you cannot really schedule people for a call because they will get scared. So you can't schedule them for a call to give them constructive feedback one-on-one. So that was kind of a shock. So it was quite a rough journey, I have to say. And we were still spending a lot of money. Money was still flowing freely until February 2022, approximately, when the Ukrainian invasion and everything happened. But then we had to do this massive change to become profitable as a company, which obviously meant very tough decisions, like reducing the team a lot. We did a massive restructuring last year, going from being over 80 employees to 40 approximately in three waves of restructuring. And I think that was very tough because the financial markets were unstable. We didn't even want to go out there and raise money. So we got support from our current investors, which I'm very grateful for, that they like could see that we have a good product. We have great clients. This is probably a temporary crisis. So let's continue supporting Doctrine. And then lots of great co-workers. We had recruited extremely talented people over the years, people who had quit similar backgrounds to me to join Doctrine that we had to let go. But luckily, all of those people, I would say, have better jobs today. It was a very difficult period, but I think it turned out well. And for me, I'm actually very grateful because I think that the company that I am running today is much more aligned with my what makes sense. If you're going to run a company, you need to have a profitable company. You cannot spend money without knowing when you will get return on that investment, if ever. And I think this whole startup craziness that we've been seeing over the past close to 10 years, it's not sound. And I think that what we see today is something that is healthy and sustainable. And actually, that decreases the stress within an organization. It's easier to be CEO if you don't spend the crazy amount of money not knowing whether that will be a good decision or not. Now we are really cautious. We spend money on things that we know will deliver return on investment. And everyone in the organization is aligned around this goal. And that makes my job as a CEO much, much easier. I think that previously in my, if I look back at my own career, I tend to change, do a major change in my career is of some sorts every 5 to 6 years. And I've often discovered that if I had been a bit more patient, I could probably have been more successful. I think the research area that I started working in 2024, people thought we were crazy, actually, wanting to investigate long-term effects of preterm birth on the cardiovascular system. And I struggled. I think I submitted my first article 35 times or something. It was like impossible to get published. Now it's common knowledge. And there are hundreds of publications. My article has been cited, I don't know, lots and lots of times. But that took 10, 15 years. And I think that we will see the exact same development in this area. So when we see the public sector starting using the same messaging we used 5 years ago now, that means that it will take another 5 years probably for the public sector to realize what we have realized over the past 7 years. And then I think that we, as a mature supplier, still like in the forefront of technological development, because we do quite a lot of technological development, and we will integrate generative AI into our product in a safe and responsible and compliant way, which is not always the case, this year or next. I think that we have the future, a very bright future ahead of us. So this time I feel that I don't want to give up or change direction prematurely, because I really think that the ones who persist and who stay in the game are the ones who are going to ultimately become very successful in this area.
I do find it very helpful to speak to folks that have walked far along the innovator's journey and listen to what they have to say. Anna Karen is particularly clear and open about her particular path and her natural tendency to move on to new challenges, perhaps a little too soon. A common question I am asked when speaking with startups is how and when to grow a company to new, often foreign markets. And I like what Anna Karen had to say about this strategy and how this sort of ties in to her natural tendency to move a little too quickly.
Our strategy has been changed by our very strong goal to first become profitable and then grow. So I'm not even sure we have a growth. Obviously, we have a growth strategy, but it's very limited growth that we are looking at for the coming 2 years, just to be sure to become profitable in a sustainable way first. But when we go into new markets, we have learned over the years that it's very dangerous to go into financially, and it's very risky to go into a new market if you don't have a very strong customer on that market before you go there, actually. And we have done that. We went into the Czech Republic with the largest healthcare provider in the Czech Republic. That was a very successful step for us to show that our solution is scalable, that we can actually work with the customer remotely. We don't have people on the ground in the Czech Republic, but we have a profitable customer that we work with remotely since several years. When we went into Norway, we did the same thing. We went with the two biggest healthcare organizations in Norway, in the private sector, to establish ourselves in Norway and to scale and grow with them, and then later acquire other customers. And now we are looking at a couple of other European countries where, I can mention one of them, it's not a secret, I think. We are looking into going into France this year, and we will do that with one of the largest healthcare providers in France. And then obviously you will grow from there. And that's the exact same pattern we've seen in Sweden. We started with the largest healthcare provider, then we signed the second largest. And then from there you can scale with medium-sized and the longer tail of smaller customers without having a too high customer acquisition cost. But I think the good thing about going into a market, whether it's Sweden or another market, with a big player, I talked a lot about the problems we had and how difficult it was and how painful it was. But the good thing is that those large healthcare organizations, they have those project teams that can spend more than 20% per week of their working time just making you successful, like leading the change projects, etc. So I think that going into a new market with smaller customers that are less mature, that's very dangerous. You need that large player to pave the way. We've clearly seen that. But then, and of course, there is some sort of like the chicken or the egg problem when you start a company in the early phases.
Successful companies in the digital health space have to solve pain points, not just problems. And they have to solve these pain points in a way that is either better, more efficient, or more cost-effective than the incumbent system can solve it today. After all, most problems in healthcare have an existing solution that, as we have already discussed, was designed at an earlier time and deployed the resources available at that time. Now, if that solution is to be replaced, and keep in mind that the solution is a known quantity, right? Some people would call it the devil that everybody knows and everybody's comfortable with. So the solution that you bring in has to be better, but not just better. It has to be better enough that it justifies all the effort, 20% of your staff's time, and 40% of your budget. So it has to be a really good solution. And I was curious what problem Doctrine was solving.
I would say that we solve three problems, which the main one is accessibility. And when we started thinking about accessibility to healthcare, we thought a lot about the patient's accessibility to healthcare. But what we have realized over the years, and that I knew already being a clinician, is that for healthcare to contact patients, that's also quite difficult. You call them, but they don't pick up the phone. So you call them again, then you call them later that day, then you write a letter, but who knows if they are even staying at that address or if they will read that letter, etc. So I think that making that accessibility bi-directional has been a success factor for us. So that's the accessibility problem. Then we have the productivity problem, where I think that the fact that we automate like the medical history taking or making sure that every clinician has the right information before even starting to interact with the patient has been a game changer. And we see that half the time a clinician spends on a consultation, actually, if they get like the problem that the patient has described in a great way. Then I think we have underestimated the power of the collaboration tools that we built into the platform quite early on, meaning that, for example, a triage nurse in primary care chatting with a patient can actually invite the patient's own doctor, the patient's own practitioner into the consultation, or get a physiotherapist that works at many primary care centers in Sweden, at least, to meet with the patient as a team in that chat room around the patient. Because what I think is that we clearly could see how the collaboration tools would shorten lead times, make work a bit more efficient. What we didn't expect was the learning that happened from doing that. Because if the triage nurse gets to see what the physiotherapists would recommend to a patient with that particular problem, the triage nurse will learn something from that. While previously she only sorted patients and she never got any feedback on what actually happened with them. So I think that learning has been a very powerful thing. And then communication, because we can see today that chatting with patients is efficient if you do it right. But there are many ways of chatting with patients in a very inefficient way. As a clinician, I think you need to solve, we have solved the accessibility problem. We have solved the silo problem. People get to collaborate around the patients. We have solved the information gathering problem. But there are still adjustments that we need to make in how staff communicate with patients using digital tools. It has to be efficient. It has to be empathetic. And the information has to be comprehensible from a patient perspective. And I think this is extra important when you do it in writing, because you will not immediately pick up if the patient doesn't understand you. In the physical situation, you might see that the patient looks puzzled, or you might clarify. But in writing, if it isn't clear, it can be dangerous, but it will also be annoying to the patients.
Fascinating, right? So not sure you picked up on this, but all three problems were essentially addressing broken systems. And we still don't know exactly what Doctrine does, do we? They solve for what? For poor access, siloed communications, and the lack of a collaboration platform, which therefore makes the solution scalable across all healthcare, doesn't it?
So basically what we do, how it works, is that the patient contacts their healthcare center, their clinic, it might be a specialist outpatient clinic in cardiology. They do that using a web application that could be either integrated into a native app or made available via a text message, for example, that is sent if a patient is trying to phone the clinic. They log in, they answer a few questions about their problem, and how many questions they answer and what questions they answer depend on the context, the age, the sex, etc. of the patient. The result of those questions are summarized as a medical history report that can be used for automatic documentation, but also serves as a basis for the clinician that will meet with the patient, usually in a digital interface where you can chat, but you can also start a video meeting with the patient if you find that is more convenient. And you can also offer to book them in for a physical face-to-face appointment using that information as basis for that consultation. And this means that it will save them a lot of time, approximately half of the time where you usually ask questions back and forth to your patient is saved by having that automatic summary. Then you might, as a clinician, find out that you will need additional help or that you are not the last step in the patient's journey. So you can invite additional competence from your own clinic, but also within a large healthcare provider organization. If you have multiple units, you can actually invite additional competence from other units into your consultation. So if you need a dermatologist in your primary care center, we see clients actually inviting dermatologists to look at images of skin conditions and help with the treatment. You can also transfer cases between clinics so that patients get a truly seamless journey. They just approve of that transfer of information and the case in every step. And you can then move from a primary care consultation for your sore knee into a specialist orthopedic consultation that same afternoon, where the clinician gets to take part of the same information and what has happened before in the patient journey. In that sense, we are a true care navigation platform for all types of outpatient healthcare. Yeah, initially people were resisting. People are still resisting. But I think it's very interesting to compare different implementations of the Doctrine platform between different settings, because some have been successful and others have not. And to get the academic view from organizational researchers on what made an implementation successful and what made it less successful, I think that has been very enriching for us, because it has confirmed our everyday experience of doing change management and see the results of it. We talked earlier about the leadership, the importance of having the leadership being available and involved and engaged all from the purchasing process, the implementation process, the follow-up process, and to continue being interested and following up on a regular basis, how is our digitalization effort going? We talked about the common vision and like having a common end goal, but being able to adjust as you go. But I think also that like planning the work in the more like operations part of the implementation is extremely important, because I think that many immature healthcare providers, when it comes to digitalization, they do not understand how important it is to respect the cognitive working environment of the clinicians. And some think that the same nurse, for example, who is answering the phone might also be able to do the chatting. We know it's obvious, it's impossible to do that in a good way. You will be super stressed. The phone calls won't be good, the chats won't be good, and the working environment will be dangerous. And then if you're gonna be able to schedule people to actually take care of the digital platform during their working day, that means that you need to be successful in driving patient behavior, because if you don't have enough patients, you won't be able to schedule a nurse for half a day or a full day to take care of the digitally incoming cases. And that's the same for the doctors. If you expect them to do 4 consultations an hour and respond to the chats at the same time, that won't be good, which means that your doctors will probably be able to only do 3 consultations an hour, but during that last quarter of an hour, they could probably respond to 5 chats at the same time. So that will increase your productivity, but you need to be willing to take some risks or initial cuts in productivity to get that gain that we see that successful clinics are getting. Then we've seen, we talked about the collaboration tools, and we've also seen that successful clinics, they collaborate more. Because if you make this a tool only for the nurses or only for the doctors, you won't reap the full benefits of it as staff. And the patients for sure won't have those seamless patient journeys. If not all professions are there, then you won't get the full benefit of the possibility to collaborate in the platform.
At this point, it kind of begs the question, I was curious about payment models and with whom they decide to collaborate. The online platforms, they need to create new payment models, or the brick and mortar systems with established payment models that are a little easier to tap into. So I'll ask Karen to get into that a little bit.
The reimbursement system is very interesting, because one of the major systems in Sweden is that you have a capitated model in primary care. So a healthcare provider gets paid a certain amount per patient per year. So you have the full integrated, almost, it's like a full integrated payer-provider model, almost, a bit like Kaiser. And that's a very good system, because if you give them the freedom to choose whatever tools they need to take care of their patients, they will be able to do that at the best effective care level, which often means that if you get to meet with your own doctor in chat and a physical consultation can be avoided, you can keep the quality high, but the cost low. So that's a good model. But then you have the more production-based models where you get paid per consultation or per surgery or etc. It's a bit more challenging from a telehealth perspective, because in the Swedish reimbursement system, many payers have limited the reimbursement. So the reimbursement is applicable only to the face-to-face consultations. So if you meet with your patients 20 minutes on video, you don't get paid. But if you have them in the room, you get paid. But all those clinics have a lot of contacts with their patients that they do not get reimbursed for at all. It's phone calls, it's letters, questions, it's pre-operative questionnaires, post-operative follow-ups, etc. So what we usually do when we go into a clinic that has a reimbursement system that is less adapted is that we start with the administrative flows that they don't get paid for. But if we are able to make those 50% more efficient, then they can usually start seeing possibilities to also make the physical face-to-face consultations more efficient. So if you prepare them better, you might be able to take 5 physical consultations an hour instead of 4, because you have a digital platform, and then you get the reimbursement system working with you. In Sweden, we've only seen in physiotherapy that they actually ask for a certain length of the physical consultation, and then it's really difficult. If you only get reimbursed if it's 45 minutes long, then you can't make it more efficient, because they will lose money.
My last question for Anna-Karin was around the value proposition she thinks doctrine delivers and for whom. In the end, there is an investment tied to any solution, and it must be balanced with a return on that investment to the payer. So here are thoughts.
I think it's because they clearly see that we solved the impossible equation, which is combining high accessibility with high productivity without compromising the work environment for staff. So you keep staff satisfaction and patient satisfaction high. And that has previously been considered as an impossible equation to solve in healthcare. I mean, you could solve the accessibility problem by having more staff, the productivity problem by making people work faster and with more stress, and patient satisfaction by giving people very costly access at any time of the day, etc. But we have solved all those three problems at a very low cost and at the same time.
I am really grateful to Anna Karen for being so candid in her assessment of her personal journey of discovery and learnings. I learned a lot from her experience as an innovator in Sweden, and many of the take-home messages she shared with us really resonated with me. In particular, I thought the importance of managing partner expectations, the importance of ensuring that adequate resources are dedicated to the success of a digital transformation, and that leadership needs to be fully aligned with the value proposition that the investment will deliver. Those are some of the tremendous take-homes. Now, I also loved her clarity of purpose, the clarity in her communications, and the clear channels for collaboration that she uses in her business dealings with her partners, because they are as important to her product as they are to her company. Anyway, I hope you found her story and her willingness and curiosity to travel and learn at the top of the conversation as inspirational as I did. See you on our next podcast. Hey there, this is Stefano again, and I'm excited to share this new podcast. I traveled the world on my sabbatical, and I was meeting healthcare innovators with incredible stories, and I just want to share them. So let's connect. I want to hear your thoughts. DM me on LinkedIn, and I will reply to every message. And if you like these conversations as much as I did, share the podcast. Give it a like. Your support will help spread these inspiring stories to even more people. Thank you.